From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Burkina Faso's government in flux. We'll also have the latest on the Ebola outbreak, some analysis of the Eastern Ukraine vote, plus today is Election Day in the U.S. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Burkina Faso's interim president, Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zida, said on Monday the army would turn over power to a transition government headed by a consensual leader in a bid to calm accusations that it had seized power in a military coup. The country's longtime president, Blaise Compaoré, stepped down last week after 2 days of mass protest over his bid to extend his rule. And on Saturday, the military appointed Zida in a move criticized by opposition politicians and Western powers seeking a return to civilian rule. Speaking to a gathering of diplomats in Ouagadougou, Zida said it was the military's understanding that the executive powers will be led by a transitional body, but within a constitutional framework. Under Burkina Faso's constitution, the head of the National Assembly should take office if the president resigns, with a mandate to organize elections within 90 days. However, the head of the National Assembly had reportedly fled the country, along with other senior members of Compaoré's regime. Zida's appointment marks the seventh time that a military officer had taken over as head of state in Burkina Faso since it won independence from France in 1960. And in Washington on Monday, officials said they were not ready to determine whether the takeover by Burkina Faso's army of the country amounted to a coup. A step that's taken could require a cutoff of U.S. assistance to that country. State Department spokesperson Jennifer Saki at Monday's daily press briefing.
We would call again for a civilian-led transition that follows the spirit of the Constitution and moves as quickly as possible toward free and fair presidential elections. The situation on the ground now is still very fluid because, as many of you know, there's a power vacuum left by the departure of President Compaoré and key leaders in the government, including members of the National Assembly. So right now, the precise makeup of Burkina Faso's transitional government is an outstanding issue. We are certainly encouraging movement to a civilian-led transition and then, of course, elections. And that is the conversation we're having. So at this point, we're still gathering facts. We're not going to make a policy or legal determination at this point in time.
U.S. State Department spokesperson Jennifer Saki. A media rights group says the African Union and ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West Africa, failed to take action in the political crisis in Burkina Faso. The Media Foundation of West Africa says it's saddened that the AU and ECOWAS did not live up to their protocols and charters on good governance. Suleiman Brahima is executive director of the foundation. He says the two organizations reacted only after citizens began protesting former President Compaoré's attempt to end his term. From Accra, Ghana, Brahima spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about Burkina Faso.
ECOWAS and AU have failed in providing leadership when it comes to issues like what is happening in Burkina Faso. We mentioned the fine protocols and charters, because if you take the ECOWAS, for example, it has a very fine protocol on democracy and good governance, within which it clearly articulates its non-acceptance of any attempt by presidents to stay on power by changing constitutions or amending constitutions to have further terms. The same with the AU. The AU charter on good governance, elections and democracy in Africa also talks about the fact that it will be unacceptable for presidents to try and perpetuate themselves in power by resorting to constitutional amendments.
Now, this attempt by the former president to extend his term certainly was not being done in secret.
In the case of Burkina Faso, over the last 3 to 4 years, it has been very clear that former President Compaoré was doing everything possible to change the constitution or amend the constitution to enable him to go for another term. This is something that was not hidden. Almost everyone who is politically active in the region knew that this was a development in Burkina Faso. And if you visited Burkina or you happened to talk to any Burkinabe, this was a very important issue as far as their politics and governance was concerned for them. The current president of the ECOWAS Commission is a Burkinabe national. And so it isn't something that the ECOWAS or the AU can say, well, we were not aware. So we are certain that when it comes to development by presidents trying to do the wrong thing, then the ECOWAS and the AU keep quiet.
Why do you think these two bodies, ECOWAS and the AU, have remained silent? Because they have been accused of this in the past, have they not?
Yes, they have. And I think that, as people would say, these institutions, rather than being for the interest of the masses or the citizenry in Africa, increasingly it is becoming clear that these are institutions that simply serve the interests of heads of state. And there are many instances to cite. Many governments in West Africa, for example, if you take the case of the Gambia, the ECOWAS court itself has made 2 or 3 judgments against the government. And yet, Yahya Jammeh continues to sit on the ECOWAS, deliberate with heads of state, make decisions, and continues to perpetrate impunity. In Africa at large, recently, heads of states decided to amend the African court protocol to grant immunities to themselves. And so increasingly, it is becoming worrying that these institutions that would at some point want to say that, well, they represent the interests of the people, would demonstrate that, well, when it comes to governance issues, it's about protecting the rights and interests of the presidents who form the leaders of these groups.
What is your reaction to the military being in charge now? What would you like to see?
Well, obviously, the change was as a result of actions by civil society and the civilian population of Burkina Faso. We don't want any tampering with the constitution. And therefore, this president should either go or at the end of his term, he shouldn't have the opportunity or he shouldn't try to go for another term. Now, what the military is doing in Burkina Faso is almost the same as, you know, tampering with the constitution, because the constitution makes it clear in the event the president resigns, in the event the president dies, who is supposed to take over. And I think that the right thing is to allow that process to go on and then prepare for elections, as the constitution says.
How important is Burkina Faso to regional security?
Burkina remains a very strategic country in terms of the peace and stability of this region. Because over the years, we know what has happened in Mali and the dangers of having fundamentalist and terrorist groups in northern Mali capitalizing on what is happening in Burkina Faso is quite imminent. We know what is happening in Nigeria. And if efforts are not made quickly to stabilize the country, these terrorist and fundamentalist groups could, you know, capitalize on this and further perpetrate acts of violence and instability in Burkina Faso. And so I think that it should even go beyond the ECOWAS and the AU. I think the international community must have a keen interest in what is happening in Burkina Faso, because Burkina, as I said, is a very strategic country in terms of regional peace and regional stability.
Suleiman Brahima is Executive Director of the Media Foundation of West Africa. He spoke from Accra, Ghana, with VOA's Joe DiCapua. Liberian officials and the World Health Organization say the number of new Ebola cases in Liberia appears to be falling, but it's too soon to be sure. Liberia has been the hardest hit by this regional epidemic, with approximately half the total cases and deaths. Kristen Roby has more from our West Africa Bureau, with reporting by Prince Collins in Monrovia.
Ebola has killed at least 2,413 people in Liberia since April. Some experts have suggested it could kill tens of thousands more by year's end. However, health authorities there say that over the past 2 weeks, the rate of infection appears to be dropping slowly. The WHO says it's cautiously optimistic. Liberia's assistant health minister and head of the government's Ebola response, Tobert Yinswa, says now is not the time to relax intervention efforts.
The safe barriers, improve our contact tracing, active case size, make sure that our number of treatment beds are increased, increase our ETUs at county level, making sure that people take preventive measures. Social mobilization should be key. Community mobilization is critical.
Doctors Without Borders runs the largest Ebola treatment unit in Liberia. It was overflowing just 2 months ago. They were having to turn patients away. Since mid-October, they've had empty beds. MSF medical coordinator in Liberia, Natasha Reyes.
We have 79 out of 190 beds occupied. So that's now less than half. And that's quite new for us. We used to have over 100 patients in the confirmed area.
She says that doesn't mean there aren't still sick people in the communities.
We need to have a better surveillance of the community. We need to have better tracing of the contacts of the patients that we have. For us to have a really good picture and for us to draw any conclusions.
The country's burial teams say they are also picking up fewer bodies. Marcus Spear runs burial operations for Margibi County, just outside Monrovia. He says community resistance remains.
There are few persons or families that are still hiding sick persons and want them to begin to cooperate with the health program.
Medical experts say Ebola victims are at their most contagious after death. Safe burial requires family members to have no physical contact with the bodies, a practice at odds with Liberian tradition. MSF's Reyes says that could still be deterring sick people or their family members from coming forward.
That may be discouraging people from accessing our center, because if I were sick, I would be afraid to go in, that if I die, I will be cremated and my family will never see me again.
Health workers say the downward trend in new cases is promising. Ramped up response efforts are having an impact. But they are quick to point out that Liberia and neighboring Guinea and Sierra Leone have seen other dips in cases over the course of this now 8-month epidemic, only to have the virus spread and resurge. Kristen Roby for VOA News, Dakar.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon spoke at a UN conference in Vienna on Monday. Among the many topics about which he spoke was Ebola.
Ebola outbreak is an unprecedented crisis for the international community, thus require global response in a massive and speedy way. That is why United Nations has been mobilizing international support in terms of logistical, financial, and political support, and also encouraging the many member states to send medical and health workers to the region. We have established the United Nations mission for Ebola emergency response called UNMIR. We are really working very hard to address this issue with utmost priority in a massive way. We really hope that we'll be able to curb down this spread of Ebola viruses.
Mr. Bond also warned against unnecessary extra restrictions on health workers returning from treating Ebola patients. Canada and Australia have banned entry of citizens from Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, where the disease is widespread. And some U.S. politicians have called for a similar ban by the United States, a measure opposed by much of the federal government.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
and
civilians.
Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
This with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Pro-Russia separatists in eastern Ukraine have elected a separatist leadership in controversial elections that Kiev and the West say they will not recognize. The United Nations, the European Union, and the U.S. have called the rebel vote illegal, saying it violates Ukraine's constitution and the ceasefire agreement reached September 5th between the separatists and Ukraine's government. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko meets later today with his security team to talk about the situation. Russia's foreign ministry released a statement saying it respected the separatist vote as an expression of the will of the inhabitants of southeastern Ukraine. John Besmers, a European analyst with the Australian National University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty Moscow's heightened belligerence may be a sign of growing frustration with Western sanctions.
You'll recall a few months ago when the Donetsk and Luhansk people wanted to organize their referenda on independence that Putin discouraged them publicly. They went ahead and had it nonetheless, but it wasn't really recognized too explicitly by the Kremlin. This time, on the other hand, they seem to be fairly forthcoming with their recognition, and I think it's a stick in somebody's eye, and only two or three guesses as to who that might be. It's a sign in particular, I suspect, that they were hoping that by making nice for a while with the ceasefire and so on, that sanctions would be eased, because the Russian economy is just starting to squeak a little bit, and I think they would be very happy to see some easing of it. Economists, including the serious economists that there still are in the Putin administration, are warning that the country is likely to go into recession quite soon on present indications. They have a lot of very negative trends running in parallel in the economy.
This comes at the same time amid reports of increased Russian Air Force activity around NATO countries. Do you see a change in Russian policy?
Yes, the aircraft activity is very worrying, but it's not new. It has turned into a bit of a perfect storm in recent weeks, but it has been going on for quite some time. Russia has been adopting very belligerent attitude towards the West as a whole, and I'm not sure to what extent this particular pattern of activity relates specifically to the elections or to even to Ukraine. It's all part of a broader picture, I think, of Russia seeking to regain its sphere of privileged interest, if we may use that term again that Medvedev popularized at one stage, which I think is a kind of Soviet Union light, L-I-T-E, but with other structures, obviously. Putin has said that it's impossible to reconstitute the Soviet Union, although he regrets very much its passing. But I think some kind of substitute organization directed and controlled to a large extent by Moscow is what he's after. And this aggression is all aimed at informing the West to get out of the way. Don't mess with us, as Putin has been saying recently. His speeches have been very belligerent, and I think he's trying to carve out a space which the West will recognize and not intrude into, and Ukraine is part of that space.
Well, does the attention now in Ukraine turn back to the battlefield from the ballot box?
Well, it's never really gone away from it, in a sense. I think there's something like, between 300 and 400 people are known to have been killed, I think, in the few weeks since the ceasefire. So it's been a ceasefire more in name than in reality. I think more of the pressure is coming from the Russian and proxy side. I don't think Kiev is too keen on more fighting at this point. I think Poroshenko found after those months in which the Ukrainians were making inroads into the landholdings of the proxies in the east, they're making quite considerable inroads, but then Russia staged basically another invasion with several thousand forces, crack forces as well, and high-quality weaponry, which turned around the fortunes of the conflict completely. And since then, I think Poroshenko has recognized that he can't win this, not by force, that he has to play it longer. And I think the proxies and the Russians, for their part, are looking to threaten some key strategic points, like, for example, the city of Mariupol, which is an important port city and one that's has been held fairly securely by the Ukrainians but has been under a good deal of attack. Also the Donetsk airport, of course. So I think the Russians are maintaining the pressure, and they can increase the pressure at any time they like.
That's John Besmers, a European analyst at Australian National University. He was speaking with my colleague Victor Beatty. Well, it's time now. U.S. voters heading to the polls today in midterm congressional elections that will shape the final 2 years of President Obama's presidency. Republicans so far are favored to gain seats in the Senate and House of Representatives in an election framed by a sour national mood and security concerns at home and abroad. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has a preview of today's election.
All 435 seats in the House of Representatives are at stake in Tuesday's voting, as well as 36 of the 100 U.S. Senate seats and 36 of the 50 state governorships. Most analysts predict Republicans will expand their House majority and have an excellent chance to win back a majority in the Senate. Republicans need a net gain of 6 seats now held by Democrats to win the majority. Polls show voters are unhappy with President Barack Obama and the direction of the country. Frank Newport is with the Gallup polling organization.
So I would say, kind of undergirding everything else that Americans may be concerned about, the economy and the availability of jobs clearly is at the top of Americans' minds this year.
The midterm stakes are important for President Obama, who's been urging Democrats to ignore the bleak predictions from experts and get out and vote.
Cynicism didn't put anybody on the moon. Cynicism has never ended a war. It has never cured a disease. It did not build a business. It did not feed a young mind. Cynicism is a choice, and hope is a better choice.
But the president may be fighting history. Two-term presidents usually suffer party losses in Congress in the second midterm election. And Mr. Obama's low public approval ratings may be hurting Democratic candidates around the country. Republicans like former National Committee Chairman Mike Duncan are cautiously optimistic about the chances of retaking a majority in the Senate.
But these races, particularly the Senate races, are very local races. And we have good candidates this time. I think we do have the wind at our back. But it's not over yet. We can't take this for granted.
Duncan says Republicans are doing all they can to nationalize this year's elections as a referendum on the president and his policies.
Well, I think the headline is that the country turns away from President Obama. We're moving the country back to being the center-right country that the American people want.
Midterm elections usually center on domestic issues, but this year the rise of the Islamic State in the Middle East and fears about the spread of Ebola have shaken the public in the final weeks of the campaign. Norman Ornstein is a political analyst with the American Enterprise Institute.
You have individual candidates and Republican candidates who have some serious weaknesses. And the best way to go around that is to nationalize an election at a time when people are unhappy and believing that things are out of control and that government's not working and that the president is not competent.
Several of the key Senate races this year are in Republican-leaning states, and late polls show many of those are trending Republican in the final hours of the campaign. The Center for Responsive Politics estimate that spending on this year's elections will reach about $4 billion, the most expensive congressional elections in history. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
And one last story for you. The U.S. city of Los Angeles, California, famously calling itself the entertainment capital of the world, but the reality is quite different. Many filmmakers have long since fled to less expensive locations, such as London, New York, Canada, and elsewhere. And now Hollywood is battling to win back its title. Over the last 15 years, film production has slumped by nearly 50% in California, once the cradle of the world's biggest film industry. Last year, the state played host to only 8% of the biggest 25 film productions of the year, including animated movies. The productions are huge moneymakers for the cities and counties which host them. Last year, 108 biggest films generated just under $8 billion in local spending and tens of thousands of well-paid jobs, that according to the group Film LA. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, if you find yourself on the internet at voanews.com, you can look under the Programs tab for a podcast of this program, International Edition. In fact, many of our programs are right there. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On November 4th, 1677, the future Mary II of England married William, Prince of Orange. The couple would later jointly reign as William and Mary. In 1825, New York Governor DeWitt Clinton poured a keg of Lake Erie water into New York Harbor, commemorating the completion of the 584-kilometer-long Erie Canal. On this day in 1847, German composer and conductor Felix Mendelssohn died at the age of 38. In 1921, on this day, Japanese Prime Minister Hara Takashi was assassinated. A right-wing extremist stabbed him, unhappy at reports that Takashi was planning to withdraw Japanese forces from Siberia. On this day in 1922, British archaeologist Howard Carter discovered the entrance to the tomb of King Tutankhamun in the Valley of the Kings in Egypt. Excavation later revealed the solid gold coffin of the boy king preserved for more than 3,000 years. In 1956, the Soviet army, backed by artillery, tanks, and warplanes, crushed a brief Hungarian revolt against the Soviet-backed communist government. Thousands were killed and injured. On this date in 1979, supporters of the new Islamic regime in Iran took dozens of people captive at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran after the deposed ruler, the Shah, was allowed to enter the United States for medical treatment. Although some captives were freed, 52 Americans would be held for a total of 444 days. In 2008, Barack Obama became the first black person to be elected president of the United States. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
A strong promoter of spreading democracy abroad through free and fair elections, the United States turns its attention homeward this week with important balloting of its own across the country. The November midterm elections will determine which political party controls the U.S. Congress and 36 state governorships. President Barack Obama isn't on the ballot, but the outcome of the national races will have a big impact on his policies and achievements in his last 2 years in office. This year's election comes at a critical time for our nation. It is the first since Russia invaded the Ukraine. A militant Islamic insurgency took control of large swaths of territory in Syria and Iraq, and the shadow of West Africa's Ebola fever epidemic touched our shores with the return of infected travelers and healthcare workers. Polls indicate that because of concern with these and other crises, American voters will go to the polls in a sour mood. Many may not even cast a vote at all. Midterm voter turnout is always smaller than when presidential candidates are on the ballot, and given popular discontent, that trend may continue. Or maybe not. The next Congress will be asked to take fateful votes on war and peace issues that will affect every American. The impact will be felt not only in congressional action in the immediate future, but it could provide potential presidential candidates with clues on how to govern if they run in 2016. Important state and local issues will also be on the ballot, such as raising the minimum wage, allowing casino gambling, spending more money on education, and legalizing marijuana. With such high stakes, political parties and candidates have spent billions of dollars to get their messages out and appeal for support. In several states that allow people to vote by mail early because of Election Day conflicts, the balloting has never been higher. Even with their discontent over the nature of politics today and unpopular government policies, Americans know elections are the best way to have their voices heard. That is the essence of democratic government, and a right that, the nation's current mood or not, few Americans would surrender.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.